The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number one, Individual Spirituality and Institutional Religion, with Lawrence Young, Mary Beth Raines, and Reba Keel.
Symposium. My name's Albert Peck. I'm the executive director of the Sunstone Symposium. I put my name tag on here. This is the 18th Sunstone Symposium. It began in 1979 at the University of Utah, and we've had one every year in the summer in Salt Lake City since then. For those of you who have been coming for a long time, you'll remember that they used to be at the end of August. They used to, in fact, be the last weekend before the Labor Day weekend. And that's no longer possible, since so many schools start before Labor Day now, and that impacts upon people's vacation plans. And many colleges start before Labor Day also, so many of our speakers are not able to attend. So we've slowly and gradually moved to the 1st of August, and I think we'll be dancing around early August, late July for some time now. So for those of you who sort of plan your calendars, think early August rather than late August for the symposium. I think that's all I'll say in matter of introduction. We'll start this evening with a prayer by Alan Toll, who is a canon theologian for the Episcopal Bishop of Utah, and he's also rector of St. Mary's Church. After Alan's praise, we'll move to a musical number by Lisa Cannon, who will introduce her own number. Thank you.
Let us pray. Good and gracious God, you are the source of life, wisdom, truth, and love. You have filled the world with beauty, and you created us, male and female, in your image. Open our eyes to behold your gracious hand in all your works, that we may rejoice in your whole creation. We pray now for your Holy Church Universal, that it may be so guided and governed by your good spirit that all who profess and call themselves Christians may be led into the way of truth, in the bond of peace, and in the doing of justice. Let your spirit of truth and wisdom be with us in the days of this symposium. Open our ears that we may hear one another. Open our eyes that we may see one another, and open our mouths that we may speak with one another. Fill our hearts with your love, that we may receive one another in dignity and in compassion. We pray for all persons who seek knowledge of you. Raise their spirits in your spirit. Guide their knowledge with your wisdom, and deepen their love in your love. May they find your presence in their lives, and in your presence discover and love all your sons and daughters. We pray for all our churches and institutions. Fill them with your spirit and wisdom, that they may embrace and raise up all who turn to them. Enable them to become lively centers of wisdom and bearers of truth. Grant that our churches and institutions may always love mercy, do the truth, and humbly serve you in all people. May we at all times find you in the welcoming arms of the crucified and risen Christ, who is the Lord of the Church and the beginning and ending of all creation, and who with you and the Holy Spirit will be worshipped to the end of the ages. Amen.
Amen.
Hello. I'm going to sing a song for you that I wrote. I've just come out with a new album that is available here. And I'll just tell you a quick little story how this particular song came about. I live in Los Angeles, and it often gets very hectic, and I took this road trip to the White Mountains in Arizona where I was going to stay in this cabin with this little piano and just have peace and quiet and write all these wonderful songs. And I arrived, and the trees were there as my audience, waiting for wonderful new songs to come out of me, and nothing was coming to me. I thought, I drove all this way. I need to find some good songs here. And finally, I just got to desperation, and I started saying a prayer. And I said, now I know, Heavenly Father, if I ask, you know, I shall receive. And I really need to receive some good songs right now. And as I was thinking about this in this prayer, I just started writing these lyrics. If you ask all and really believe, you can walk on the surface of bottomless seas. You can move mystic mountains like castles of sand. You can empty your heart, and then you can listen the sound of your heart beating fast as it echoes to send you all that you ask. And I looked at that, and I went, well, maybe that's a good start. And so it became this song called The Old Man at Point Reyes, because I kind of wrote this sort of fictitious story around it. And I'd never been to Point Reyes, which is up above San Francisco, and finally I went to it after I'd written a song, and it fit the mood just perfectly. But I thought it was very interesting that it was named after a Spanish explorer, La Punta de los Reyes, which means the Point of Kings.
Of Utah, and then suburban Washington, D.C. For me, the church called me to be social, to be kind, asked me to develop every talent I had, asked me to serve and to be served and to love and to be loved. And I think back on those times, and what I would call spirituality, and the teenagers would stand up in youth conference and say, I know the church is true. So much of that was, I know that the social, spiritual is good. That is true. At that synchronous. And my understanding of spirituality lasted for a long time through my mission and the BYU wards. But as I took classes from BYU professors who would have me read things like Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, and would say, you know, see, the problems with the Grand Inquisitor also are problems we have in the church, I began to see challenges in the church. And while I still loved it, it wasn't everything in my spiritual journey. And now there are many things I value in other religious traditions and that I've gained on my own journey, which I don't find celebrated in Mormonism. One time that was a problem. Now I find no problem with it, but they are additional supplemental avenues and journeys that I take outside of Mormonism, and that may be true for everyone. Trying to understand that journey is a difficult challenge, because you always want the church to be everything that it is and that was in your youth, and that may not be true. Anyhow, we've asked three panelists to explore this issue from three different but related academic disciplines. First, we'll hear from Larry Young, who is a professor of sociology at BYU. His specialty at present is sociology of religion. Larry has written on sociology of religion. He co-edited a book on contemporary Mormonism, looking at it. But most of his research has been done studying the Catholic Church. And he has won numerous national awards in the sociology of religion for his work, particularly in the Catholic Church. Second, we'll hear from Mary Beth Raines, who is a psychologist, a counselor. Whereas Larry deals with sociology, the larger issues, Mary Beth deals with individuals and their journeys and the interior dynamics of what goes on in our lives. And Mary Beth, for years, has been a columnist on these sort of matters in Sunstone, although she has been less frequent in her contributions of recent than in the past, but not because I don't encourage her to write. And maybe this public chiding will get some of those back burner things up to the front. Mary Beth has been a contributor at Sunstone Symposiums for many years, and I think we know of the contributions she makes, and they are substantial and have affected my life very much. Our third speaker is Reba Keel, who is a professor, or has been a professor, of organizational behavior, which is sort of taking the individual, sort of in between the two disciplines of psychology and sociology. Wouldn't you say?
It's a bastard child.
When you look at how individuals act in organizations, so you're looking at individuals and the larger social dynamics, but especially within organizations. Reba Keel taught for many years in the Department of Organizational Behavior at BYU. And she also was a leading light for years in the Honors Program and made it the great program that many people remember it to be. She then left BYU and went to the University of Utah, where she worked very hard to improve their honors and general education programs, although that's not exactly what it's called at the U. I know BYU's terminology more than the U's. What was the actual...
Never mind, the rhetoric's different from the reality.
Recently, Reba was released without a vote of thanks from that role at the U, although she still is a professor in their management program. And she'll be our third speaker. After them, we'll have some, they'll be able to respond to each other, and then we'll have some time for some general questions. Warn you early, if you want to ask a question, you're going to have to go over to that microphone, which will be moved closer to those chairs, and you can sit on those chairs if you want to wait for a question. That is so that people who listen on the tape recordings will be able to hear the questions. And those of you who buy tape recordings will appreciate this inconvenience that we're causing on the people who ask questions tonight. I hope you will respect that. We'll now hear from these three speakers.
Well, I'm glad Albert reminded me that the tape recorder is going, because I was going to start by relating my most memorable presentation at Sunstone, which was a time that I had an anal fistula. Any of you know what that is? And it had just burrowed its way through my flesh about 40 minutes before the first before I was supposed to present. So I had like pus and blood coming out of a new hole, and it was a very awkward situation. And I wasn't going to mention that now because it's on tape, and I guess I just did.
Let me also indicate that I know how audacious. My undoubtedly part of it. I want to begin my comments. I do this in order to. That is, I want this to separate duality. Phenomenological argument. The essence of primal and precognitive non-rational encounter is, for example, in the mist of life is not a cognitive that I alone. Rather, what I'm referring to experience his classic study of Martin Buber of the imperative captured within the story, sublime melon of the dialectic. That is, when we attempt to preserve the source of by naming or placing in ritual, we lose the actual. We leave the phenomenon. Again, the experience is other than, but it is only by attempting to preserve the institutional form via symbol that we are able to remember the and provide structured pathways. It is this imperative to capture the actual phenomenon in symbols and stories that leads phenomenologists to argue that precognitive, non-rational experience is the constitutive element. When we have the encounter, we feel compelled to name it and give it meaning. This is the way we remember it and share it with others. While it appears that this encounter is broadly experienced across space-time, there is tremendous variation in symbols and stories which make us aware of the possibility of something to give meaning to the encounter. Similar to Buber's notion of sublime melancholy, Thomas O'Day argues that the very thing that makes possible the survival of religion, namely its institutionalization, also potentially undermines the essence of religion. He states, religion is first of all a response to the ultimate and the sacred, which are grasped as relevant to human life. Furthermore, religious response to the ultimate or sacred is religion's constitutive element, and out of religious response proceeds the process of elaboration and standardization of religious institutions. O'Day suggests that since this experience involves the deep engagement of the person involved with a beyond, which is sacred, it is unusual in a special sense. It would remain fleeting and impermanent and beyond our grasp if we did not embody it in institutional structures to render it continuously present and available. But it is this very process which produces the central dilemma in religion, in bringing together two radically heterogeneous elements, ultimacy and concrete social institutions, the sacred and the profane. This necessary institutionalization involves a fundamental tension. Peter Berger also asserts that at the heart of the religious phenomenon is pre-reflective pre-theoretical experience. The heretical imperative presents Berger's clearest exposition of this position. After discussing the nature of religious experience, Berger argues that while religion's essence is understood to be first and foremost grounded in experience, which stands outside of everyday mundane reality, religion is more than just pre-reflective, pre-theoretical experience. It's also experienced as tradition. Religious experience, Berger explains, in consequence of its non-rational nature, comes to be embodied in traditions, which mediate it to those who have not had it themselves, and which institutionalize it for them as well as for those who have. The special character of religious experience, however, creates a number of problems. Religious experience, the core of religion, breaches the reality of ordinary life. While all traditions and institutions, including religious traditions and institutions, are structures within the reality of ordinary life, inevitably, this translation tends to distort. Traditions may be imperfect vehicles, but as Berger later suggests, there is no way to avoid this distortion. The insertion of the supramundane into mundane reality inevitably distorts it, but only by virtue of this distortion can even a faint echo of the original experience be retained amid the humdrum noises of everyday life. So, I've aligned myself with those who assert the essentialness of institutional religion if we're to make accessible the encounter with the sacred to as many people as possible. And it is this encounter with which is spirituality for me. It should come as no surprise that I'm always a little disturbed by those who deconstruct institutional religion without simultaneously acknowledging that they are deconstructing the most reliable and sustainable mechanism we know of that gives access to the spiritual. Deconstructing the spiritual is serious business, and anyone engaging in such actions, including those of us at Sunstone, ought to view it as something more than a mere language game. Given what I've said, it would appear that I'm a champion of institutional religion because of what I view as the necessary link between institutional religion and individual spirituality. And in truth, I don't know how to express or give meaning to my own religious experience or spirituality outside the context of culturally mediated symbols and stories such as those we receive from institutional religion. Let me illustrate this dependency with an excerpt from a recent meditation on God that I wrote. Note the paradox in being wholly dependent upon institutionally, that is, culturally derived symbols and stories, to give expression to a primal encounter that cannot be adequately expressed in any discourse. Beyond that, note the imperative I feel to give meaning to the encounter, something which makes me, again, dependent upon symbols and stories derived from institutional religion. So now the meditation. The most essential thing about my encounter with God is the sense I have of God's love for me. I experience it as the conscious and consuming love of a being who is father and mother, friend and lover, king and queen, redeemer and teacher. This sense of the conscious love of a transcendent being is the most real thing in my life. Yet I do not know cognitively that God is a being. I have hope, and I live in faith. What faith I have is experienced as a gift from God that I receive when I open myself up to it. The core of religion for me is this love from God. The love is experienced as the fulfillment of hope, as the essence of joy, as God's simultaneous acceptance and understanding of me, as I am coupled with God's infusing capacity or infusing, as I experience God infusing me with the capacity to be better and more than I am. I experience God's love as unconditional and always available. God does not offer me solutions and answers. Rather, God offers me this love. God's love is the solution and answer. This love is the ultimate thing in and of itself. It provides the ultimate grounding. It fills life with meaning. I also experience it as the source of enhanced strength, insight, joy, compassion, and patience. It gives me the ability to accept and celebrate reality as it is. The love of God teaches me how to love others. Because the most essential thing I experience is the love of God, I sense that the most essential thing I can give others is my love. Again, this is not a love that is an abstraction. It is concrete and it is consequential. When I'm living my life the best, there are only three things that ultimately matter: to live in God's love more fully, to accept love from others, and to love others better. And by others, I mean God and trees and rocks and rivers and dogs and the president of BYU and so on and on. My capacity to undertake a meditation like I've just read and my capacity to share it with others is a product of institutional religion. Nevertheless, notwithstanding my belief in the essentialness of institutional religion, let me also acknowledge my simultaneous ambivalence towards at least some manifestations of it. I could talk about having a lawsuit threatened by a group of conservative Catholic bishops to block me from publishing a book that I wrote. I felt ambivalent about institutional Catholicism. But what I'm going to focus on here is I'd like to read some excerpts from a very long letter. I'll only read some excerpts that I sent to last summer to Alan Wilkin, who was and is the academic vice president of NYU. The occasion of the letter was to plead for a reconsideration of the university's decision regarding Gail Houston's tenure. I wrote, "I want you to know that my most deeply held hope is that this sad situation can serve as a catalyst to lead us to reflect on how we can best make our university a community of scholarship and faith." Gail's dismissal reminds me of the core problem I experience. I do not feel safe talking about the most essential part of my life, that part where there is a sense of God's living presence, that part where I experience the insertion of God's love into the here and now, and where I experience waves of transcendence sweeping over me. I believe that embedded within this experience is a transformative imperative which alters beliefs and action for the better. It is the foundation of my faith in and love for Christ. Even though this is the most important thing I have to say, and something I've spent a great deal of time reflecting upon, I do not feel safe talking about it at BYU. It's not because there is anything heretical in the witness I have to offer. Rather, it seems to me that the problem exists because we as an institution have become more concerned and committed to the pursuit of orthodoxy than spirituality. And we've confused uniformity and unreflective obedience with unity, authentic community, trust, and commitment to the gospel. I fear that administrators and other members of the BYU family, who are individuals of goodwill, who are spiritually alive, who desire to serve God the best they know how, and who are making significant sacrifices to build a community of scholarship and faith, are nevertheless engaged in action producing unintended consequences that in many instances undermine the very task. What we are taught as a community by the actions of those in power is that it is safer and wiser to avoid certain questions and issues entirely unless we're willing to adopt the answers provided by those who have the power to interrogate, threaten, and even when the gospel does not place closure on the address. Of course, along the path to this discovery, we have individuals like Gail Hughes who have sought to be open, honest, authentic, and faithful. One of the things I've learned as I've spoken with some of Gail's students is that her commitment to this combination of values has helped foster an environment in which the students have experienced spiritual growth and development. These students have experienced Gail's tutelage as the essential component in their capacity to bring together the dual goals of faith. Because of Gail, they have developed greater confidence in the capacity to simultaneously pursue truth and foster faith around extremely difficult issues. They have been able to utilize Gail in this fashion, even as Gail has to grow and develop in her understanding capacity of the life in Christ. The genuineness flowing out of Gail's openness and honesty has led several of her students to have faith in the possibility of feeling more authentically loved by them. These experiences have served to bind students to Christ who might otherwise have been. So Gail's dismissal is experienced as a contradiction. The contradictions result in either or both an alienation from the institution or an undermining of individual faith and spirituality. Last summer, I told you that I believe one of the saddest elements of the current organizational culture at BYU is that we expend tremendous efforts in seeking to protect our community from evil and controversy. And so we spend much of our time looking for it. Consequently, the reality we see is a community filled with shadows of evil and dark everywhere. I believe that if we instead focused on finding the face of God's grace smiling upon us, we could look at the same reality and see the light of God's grace smiling all around us. Our approach to the same reality constructs fundamentally different. This means when we look at an individual or an institution, including Mormonism, our own hearts frequently determine what shadows. When I look at Gail Houston, I see God's grace. I see God's grace manifested when Gail openly and honestly confronts difficult questions. I see God's grace when I see her going far beyond the normal expectation. I see God's grace when I have a conversation where she shows respect and awareness for issues to grapple with. So many of us have lost the joy of discovering the good in one. Our community's interaction with our sister Gail could be, and we would be strengthened by. Instead, we seek conformity, and our efforts lead to unintended misinterpretation. I understand that the people who sat in judgment on Gail Houston sought to anticipate that at least some of them felt the Spirit of God as they sat in deliberation. But in the end, I believe their judgments reveal more about their own hearts as worthiness. Let me reiterate. that I understand that at least some of those involved in determining legally unacceptable sought to have their judgments influenced. But I also believe that they would have reached a different determination if our organizational culture was more firmly rooted in God. I believe that if these individuals allowed the love of Christ to work on their hearts, they would look at Gal and see new possibilities. I believe that we as a community would shine brighter upon the hill as a witness to Christ if we approached one another anticipating. I believe we have lost something because of the way we approach the citizens in our community. I believe we've lost something because of the judge, but we've lost its grace. So where does all of this lead? I don't know how to fully live in God's love outside. I don't see how the core of religious experience can transmit to other people outside religion. And I don't understand the arrogance who feel that they have transcended their dependence still in the very mess. At the same time, I feel ten and aims that reflect upon the dark side of institutional. And I don't understand the arrogance as heresy. Is there any way out of this morass of ambivalence I find myself? Is there a way to constitute institutional religion to maximize duality and minimize authentic yet remain supportive of institutional religion? If we were to collectively engage in an effort to articulate what it looked like, I'm quite confident we would come up with a form that would animate some of us in this hall tonight more fully and authentic than the present form of institution. Yet I'm equally confident that our efforts would eventually to the loss of vitality and the capacity of the institution evoke the with the greatest amount. That's a pretty audacious statement I made, but I believe it. I think what we would come up with in the end probably the loss of it. Perhaps this is an issue we could explore during the
Tracing states, the introductory essay concluded by saying that cannot focus on individual or the how to comprehend the slice of the man, and stated that actually part of the greatness of the last stand, the dynamic tension and balance of always holding individual social cohesion. I'm taking the same stance as Larry, that in all or vehicles I use in life to feel most meaning in life, to feel most aliveness, it is the avenue of my ultimate concern. It is how I feel most connected to what I call spirit or God, and that what we usually end up in arguments and debates about in terms of what is spirituality is often the vehicle to it. Some people, in fact, we had breakfast yesterday morning discussing this, and we were having a bit of a debate, I could see, in that some of us were thinking that, well, maybe it is a contact with the transcendent. That's Larry's position. Another person said, well, I think service is actually real spirituality. I think also some of us have had the experience of and may continue to have the experience of the greatest sense of connectedness and depth of meaning in life and indeed most aliveness when living the gospel in the way that we define it. At times it's in living the commandments and actually have a great experience maybe searching the congruence between how the text appeared in the ensign with how we actually heard it. Now, I'm not there at the moment, but I do remember those experiences, and I remember feeling very alive and actually either had numinous or transcendent experiences at that time, and at other times had very rational, reasonable experiences. There are also religions in the world who use reason and intellect and understanding as the vehicle to the sense of self, the transcendent, the deepest spirituality, even beyond the self, and indeed a connection to the community. So I would like to say that we often end up in arguments, but it's about the vehicle and not about the core of spirituality, which is that depth of connectedness and meaning and aliveness, which also has a set of core feelings. And it's the feeling process where I think we feel the most connected, and that is awe, wonder, an expansion beyond our limited self, a sense of meaning. Larry called that pre-rational and precognitive. I think that's true for people who are at precognitive and pre-rational stages. I don't think it's true for people who are at other stages, which include still what is pre-rational and precognitive in us. Much as the brain is built sequentially, one system on top of another and includes the other, and if you don't think your neocortex pays attention to your limbic system, just watch your impulses from day to day, that essentially our spirituality is developed in a series of stages, and every one of those stages involves a relationship with an institutional church or some social organization. So let me use this overhead projector. Reba's kindly lent me a sheet, and I've written things out hastily. A concrete example of how the self, the individual self, is embedded in a larger self context is that probably only 10% of what I'm going to say tonight are my words. I've talked about this topic with many friends over the last few weeks since Albert called me, I think in desperation, right? I was one of the last ones on your list. And so I borrowed heavily, including this idea from friends. I'm going to make an analogy between how the self develops in relationship to others and that the relationship process is crucial and dependent upon two individual selves or two other coordinates. So it's a triangle relationship that over time is, and I've tried to indicate the stages through those circles and arrows. Essentially, one of the best analogies to this whole process of development of spirituality in a relationship with the institutional church is marriage, or if not marriage, an intimate partnership, or a friend with which you have the most core connection in life, so that if you draw an analogy with something that has a core or depth process in you to another, I think we'll get the best approximation. But rather than focus entirely on that, I'm going to move directly to individual spirituality and the church. During the first stages of growth, from the time we're very young, the time we're born, until we're 8 or so, and actually they have it kind of on the line in terms of developmental psychology. It's about 8 that we start to develop different capacities. But essentially, we take the institution that we're given, and that is during our precognitive and pre-rational years. We take it, we try it on, we wear it, we have no choice of other clothes at times. We like or we don't like what we, you know, going to primary or singing songs or whatever we do. I'm using the Mormon Church as an example now, of course. And that is our spirituality. Spirituality is the church. It is living the commandments. It is doing what God says. And if you watch young children and you watch it in benevolent form, there's some fairly interesting research that says the church is very good at bringing children through the first stages of moral reasoning, of ethics training, of learning service, of learning about other people, of learning about their own curiosity. And so the first stage is that sense of aliveness or that sense of meaning or that sense of ultimate purpose. But somewhere along the line, and if any of you have children or grandchildren or whatever, you will notice this. My 2-year-old granddaughter is writing out this at the moment of saying, me, Mary, Daddy, Temple. I mean, she's just 2. She just turned 2. So she's starting to fuse words with herself, with another person. She's always got 3 in juxtaposition. She's also saying this about Cinderella and Beauty and the Beast, too. So she's still trying on forms. At some point, older than age 8, actually at the age in which we call adolescence, we start to differentiate. We start to develop an individual self apart from the institution we have. In intimate relationships, the first stage is one of fusion, merging, honeymoon, falling in love. We identify with how we're similar. That's how we end up getting married or connected or partnered in the first place, right? If we start to identify with what is dissimilar and what we don't like about the other, we never make it. This is why so many people end up, in fact, I think in California, there's a waiting period, or at least to be a waiting period, and if you wait something like 3 weeks after a marriage license to get married, so many people end up not getting married. The next stage, after fusion or merging or collectiveness, is individuation. And we have the illusion that that individuation stage in our spirituality, in relationship to the church, or in a relationship, is apart from, not connected to the other. I maintain we cannot be an individual, and we cannot have individual spirituality, an inner depth process of continuing meaning, and wider sense of whether it's numinous or service, unless we have a social context. And let me give an example about individual spirituality. There are many of us, myself included, who went through a fairly long stage in which I was primarily, while sitting in church, having big, long discourses of disagreement with everything that was said. This was my complaining loudly, obeying blindly stage, in which I was differentiating what I thought by comparing what I knew to history, what I knew to how the style of somebody said it. The fact that this person was standing up there was male and I was female. And going through every social injustice, which I don't think were unreal, which in fact are real, yet I use that beginning stage of differentiation, which most of us do, by defining myself with what was not, as well as kids do in adolescence, what rules they don't like, what they don't like about you as a parent. And in relationship stages, it's that stage what we call the disillusionment stage. It's where we say to ourselves, what was I thinking when I really partnered up with this person? What did I have in mind that I could really spend the rest of my life living with somebody who, and then the list goes on and it's long or short or whatever, right? Oftentimes, this is a very long, ambivalent time, but it's absolutely necessary. The second substage of this differentiation, individuating from stage, from the other stage, is noticing actually what we want that's separate from, but still in connection to. And this, the problem here, basically, is that we don't have good language. We have words that define separation, and we have words that define connection or fusion, but we don't have very good words that show both. But we are, in fact, juxtaposing ourselves to and from. It's kind of an either-or stage. And at that time, in our spirituality, most people will experience less experiences of the transcendent that Larry talked about. Most people will experience more experience with rationale, with reasons, with social action, with injustice. And during this stage, particularly, we often have anger or we have disillusionment to fuel that. If you'll think about that, that is also what happens during adolescence. In order to get an adolescent through adolescence, however, they absolutely need families to push and pull from, just as we need an object that's pretty solid to resist and push and pull from. I'm trying to say something that's quite complex in a short time, so if I muddy it over, I hope we can discuss it. But essentially, those relationships, both in terms of marriage partners, in terms of parents and children, in terms of, I think, self and the institutional church, who find a way through and hold on to both threads, somehow emerge with a whole different and third stage that many marriages never get to and many individuals don't. As we reach that stage, though, in this individuation or juxtaposing in various ways, I never can find the right set of conjunctions, there are many paths. Some people continue to become more rational in the sense that they use their mind and their reasoning, their awareness, in alliance with the church. They don't ever take a substantial disagreement. Other people will leave entirely and say, enough for me, I think I'm getting a divorce, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm not even Mormon. Other people will have a cyclical process of in and out or in and out, and Larry describes it perfectly. How do I live this paradox? I'm living both at the same time. I don't have a way to resolve it, but here it is. If you can continue in some way to keep a hold of a social institution, and for those of us who choose to leave and have no association whatsoever, our social institutions or our community group often becomes reading. It may become other groups. There's a community of people who write books that we then commune with, right? Some of us have felt our most experiences of transcendence when we were actually having an illuminating intellectual experience. And I submit that, in fact, the numinous or the transcendent includes the rational, and in this last stage, It's not necessarily the last, but this, for our purposes tonight. The third stage is that there's some sort of cohesion and integration. So beyond individuation, then comes integration. Excuse me. You work through both, and you somehow find a new conjunction. The paradox is not solved, but it's resolved. Neither side holds sway over the other. Somehow there's a new connection, and it becomes both and instead of either or. In a relationship, and it generally takes about 15 years or more in most marriages, if they ever reach it, and this is a minority of couples, in 15 years or more, couples will start to say, well, you know, we're two individuals, and yet we have this wonderful relationship where we're friends, but it's not, you know, like erotic and euphoric all the time, but no, there are times of romantic, and there's not a way to express somehow this integration that is absolutely necessary to have a successful marriage over 40 or 50 years. The same is true of an individual self. The same is true, I think, of a relationship to whatever spiritual community you choose. Whether it's books, whether it's social action communities, whether it is a community that is an institutionalized church such as the Mormon Church. So I'll end this on a personal note. I have chosen to remain partially active within the church. Part of the reason for that is that I have two children who are Orthodox. Part of the reason for that is that I have all of you. And that is, I have access to what you read, what we read commonly, what you speak, what you say. I have access to you, to all of you in small groups. And I have to say, without this vehicle, I would never have arrived here. I would still be, in some ways, probably back in another stage of sitting in sacrament meeting and arguing all the time in my head. So I want to thank you collectively and individually for all of you who have been my friends. And it feels like at this stage, for me at least, that it is both and. That it's living in a paradox, or what is at the beginning stage, or even the second stage, looks like hypocrisy, or oddness, or oxymoron, or something that doesn't work together. But I submit that it actually is, because we've constructed it in either or ways in our brain and in our social institutions and the way we define that. It's necessary, but it's not enough. So that when we get to this last stage, and it's not the last stage by any means, I'm just saying that stage of integration, we experience, if we experience our deepest core meaning in terms of the transcendent, we experience that, as one writer calls, trans-rational. Much like the Trans-Canada Highway, which does not negate highway, does not negate any province in Canada, but includes them all. It includes all of our experiences rather than exclude it. Whereas a good relationship includes and likes the foibles of their partner, despite having to suffer along with it. And I believe that that's also our relationship to the institutional church, if we choose to stay aligned with it. And if we leave, we will also pick up that same argument with whatever group we align with. We'll go through those stages again. I'm deeply grateful for all that I have received from all of you, from all those authors I have read, and I think the individual spirituality grows as we're willing to take along the rough and tumble circumstance of each stage. Thank you very much. I want to thank Albert for having given me my epitaph. She was released without thanks. Over and over and over again. I was probably the shortest young special interest committee member in history. I lasted through one meeting when they said, how can we get people to come to dances? And I asked, why are we having dances if people aren't coming? And was released the next day. I also was released without thanks as Merrill Bateman's Stake Relief Society president when he took over from Duane Dudley some years ago. So I have a long history of being pretty pragmatic about what things can be done and what things can't.
Please don't mistake my very plain language for disagreeing with anything either Larry or Mary Beth has said. I'm trying to say it from the point of view of the organizational person, and I'm trying to say exactly the same kind of thing. I think we're all saying no easy answers, folks, and you can't say the institutional church is driving me away or that that person who is going and doing this meditation stuff is somebody that is not should not be acceptable in the institutional church. I remember when I was Stake Relief Society president and Dwayne Dudley was the stake president was the time when Ezra Taft Benson sent the letter cautioning about transcendental meditation as a satanic rite, and Dwayne read us the letter, and then he said, frankly, I think it would be a good thing for some of our people to think. That's the paradox. That's the paradox we're talking about. Now, what I'm saying here, and I'm sorry, but I don't feel like turning on my computer today. Michael Toth and Joe Bentley. Michael's at Portland State as a sociologist. Joe Bentley's at the U in management. Who said that organizations exist. All organizations exist. Because we need, as a species, membership, order, and meaning. And our affiliation with those organizations and which ones we choose to emphasize in our lives depend upon how well they meet those pieces for us. Mary Beth suggests that this may be developmental. As we talked in breakfast yesterday, that does not mean normative or hierarchical. It does not mean that one stage is better than another. It means that at different points in our life, membership might be more important to me, or believing in some kind of order may be more important to me than finding some personal meaning, or there may be differences in how I create personal meaning, which is, I think, also what Mary Beth and Larry were both talking about. But they're mediating variables that are going to make a difference at any individual moment of my life, which of these matters more for me. One is gender. I hear Larry say, gee, how can you deconstruct the church? I think that's easier for a white married male to say than it is for a single female. I just think, you know, there are positions that we see different filters. That does not mean we might not end up at the same point. Okay, it just means I have to understand that that's one of my filters. Race, which very few of us in this room understand. None of us understand what it is to be brown or black in this society, especially those of us who are old enough to remember exactly where we were on the day the priesthood was given to blacks and can tell you what was going on at that time. Age, those of us who grew up with David O. McKay as prophet had a New Testament experience that those of you who are in a younger generation never have experienced in your church life. Class, and we try very hard to pretend there is no class. I think it is very instructive that we move between Polynesian wards and integrated wards and Latino wards and integrated wards, and we just move back and forth, and it comes down to we have never solved the class issues and never confronted them directly in terms of membership, order, meaning, who deserves full membership. Worldview, and I hate to say this, but there's an increasing amount of research which seems to show that your basic orientation toward optimism or pessimism may have a very large genetic component. And so whether you see the world, there is one sociobiologist who said those people who were not pessimistic about the world froze to death under the fruit trees during the Ice Age. I think that's kind of a nice point. That we have some predisposition to look at the world with some concern. Our culture and our myths. Is our culture one of institutions or is it of individuals? And I think that's one of the dilemmas that as an organization, as an institution, we have had as we go into countries where there is a serious conflict between those two. America, Garden of Eden, the individual, all of this Western, rural, conservative orientation has very little to do with the realities of Asian life and very little to do with the cultures that may have a different mythology. Family history will make a difference. Our occupation, if we work to make a living, we may respond very differently to the institutional church than if we work to make our meaning. And we might find our meaning in our job, or we might find our job somewhere, or our meaning elsewhere. I found it interesting that a few years ago there was a study that found that 60% of men who worked overtime reported that they did so to avoid their families. I could not help leaping from that to the fact that at that time bishops were putting in an average 40-hour week as volunteers and wondered what that was about in terms of occupation and meaning. Family status, and by that, that may mean marital status, but it may also mean family status. Some of us don't belong, and so our membership needs may be different than others. Some of us may understand that we can never belong because of that family status, and so we don't believe in membership as being a need that can be met. Our self-concept, and then, of course, the number of choices we have for membership. If I can choose lots of different things, this is a gross exaggeration, but I see that in Federal Heights a lot. You get the comments in the newspaper about various issues in the church, and it's just kind of this wide-eyed, gee, why would anybody do that or feel that way about something that's happened? Well, they're very isolated and protected by the income, by the choices they have, it is like a doctor in Utah County who became a Mormon because it was good for his practice. And there are just a lot of those kinds of issues that come up, so that membership order and meaning assumes greater or lesser influence for the individual in that moment of their life. There are also environmental scripts, and Mary Beth called this the church issues. I'm putting that word into her mouth. She did not. But I think there are scripts that tell us, I think they're very different scripts for different genders. Very different scripts for different races. Very different scripts for different cultures about what's acceptable, what you can do and belong, what you can't do and belong. And geography. I thought, as Albert said, he grew up out in Washington, D.C., and I thought about my growing up in Carbon County in Utah, which is only 20% Mormon, and being asked in the sixth grade what I thought about the Mountain Meadow Massacre, which, surprisingly enough, had not come up in any meetings that I'd been in up to that moment. And that's very different than had I grown up in Emory, where I was born, or Manti, or Salt Lake City. Or I have a former staff member who grew up non-Mormon Japanese in Utah, and none of us can understand what that's like someone. So all of those are factors that get in our way or that determine where we're moving at a particular moment. So, do I need to belong badly? As an adolescent, I probably do. What choices do I have of membership groups? If I don't think I can be compliant enough with the standard established by an institutional church, I will look for a group which establishes countervailing standards. I think it's fascinating that Al-Anon and Odyssey House and other drug programs have said that they find it very much more difficult for young people to get off drugs in Utah. Because it has a symbolic meaning And I remember Karen Shepherd saying that she can't believe that she started smoking when she came to Utah back 1,000 years ago and did it for a while just because it was the quickest signal to people that she was not part of the dominant group. And I think it's interesting that we have a very high smoking rate in the... So the belonging piece is, it becomes this kind of thing. How much can we stand? Okay, I don't understand what you do. All the folks say me. And sometimes we can do that and sometimes we can't. We just can't do it anymore. And if we can't do it anymore, we may choose not to be in the audience. Our need for structure at a particular time will be different. And so we may choose compliance in order to have structure. Our internal, if we have an internal locus of control, an institutional interaction may be less important. I think that's part of what Mary Beth is saying when she says she reads and gets this interaction with herself. If we have an external locus of control and one is not better than the other, then we might need membership more than we need order or meaning. If we can't tolerate ambiguity, and that's not a judgmental statement, because I suspect that may come very deeply from within our inner selves almost from the time we're born. If we can't tolerate ambiguity, then we cannot choose other than order and membership. Eric Fromm, about 45 years ago, wrote a wonderful book called Escape from Freedom, trying to understand why humans over and over and over go back to fascist systems. And Stanley Milgram did the same with his book on obedience to authority, that there are two conflicting tendencies or urges in human beings. One is to be absolutely individual. There is no one else like me. And the other is to be part of a group who is accepted and belonging to that group. Both of those are primary in us, and we can't meet all of them all of the time. So what is our individual response to those kinds of conflicts? Well, for some of us, we may decide we're going to belong to the out-group with that uniform, or... How come you're limping? I've got a big rock in my shoe. Why don't you take it out? I can use the extra height. For me, that was the phase of sitting in the back bench saying, I'm so mad about all of this that I could hardly stand it. For others of us, this is truly the case. I mean, I worked with a student a couple of years ago at the U who introduced his wife always as, this is my wife, Gordon B. Hinckley's granddaughter. But simplify organizational chart, and the man says, it doesn't matter which one you are. It only matters which one you aren't. And that may be the membership piece for some of us. And some of us spend a lot of time asking an irrelevant question. Paper or plastic? And what I'm saying by that is sometimes we can't win. There is no way either is going to give us meaning, order, or membership, no matter how hard we try. I guess my on the soapbox and why I get released without thanks is that I would say any logical debates such as this leave me cold. And frankly, I get a little tired of some of them. And I really can't coordinate anything done. Got some change? Look at this guy. He's a victim of wasteful social programs that sapped his incentive to work and deprived companies of money they could have used to hire him. That's bull. He's a victim of greedy, short-sighted corporations that view people as disposable and feel no responsibility to anything other than their bottom lines. I I guess my impatience with Sunstone, the institutional church, and all of the other parts comes when the ideological debates leave the please help person standing at the line, and we're debating the accuracy of the terminology. And isn't it time that we do something non-ideological?
Okay, well, we'll give each of the panelists time for some second thoughts or questions to each other if they so feel inclined. Anyone want to grab the microphone? You can stand up or...
Apparently, if I say anything, you know, so I'm not going to take exception with anything.
Good choice, man. Good choice.
Yeah, it'd be too ideological. Look, for me... One of the manifestations of this I hit up against again and again, I would guess at least 10 times a year, I have a student stagger into my office and say, I don't know where else to go. And they're pretty desperate if they've ended up in my office. And they say, you know, I don't feel safe anywhere else speaking the truth about what I'm going through right now. And I think maybe you've figured it out, Larry. Give me an easy answer to how to stay. And they've got tears streaming down their face, and their world is collapsing around them, and they're trying to figure out how to hold it all together. I see real tension there, and I want to honor where they're at. And I know that the way I have found to live my life out is probably not the best way for them to live it out. But for me, there's the tension. I don't want to pretend it isn't there. And I grapple with it. So I'm looking forward to hearing from you about how you're solving it. You may help me deal with my students.
I think that's profoundly non-ideological. And the greatest gift you can give to students is to honor their battle and say, my solutions aren't going to work for you. No one's will work for you.
I see us as in fundamental agreement that action is as important as thinking, as debate, as the internal struggle with the self. And I would guess, actually, I'm agreeing that we need to hear from people in the audience, that most of us here, even though we're very interested in concepts and how to put this all together, most of us, by the fact that we got ourselves out here tonight, right, are probably social action oriented. We do something in the world. And we do it on an everyday basis, and we do it without thanks. And we do it at times invisibly. And I think that deserves thanks, even though we only have a partial response to only partial of only some of the conundrums. In other words, all of us, even though I think we're probably taking action, we're doing it out of the best compassion we have, and in my mind those are those later stages, we have both more reason and more compassion together, that we only can do it partially, meaning there's not enough action possible with one person to take care of all the suffering. And I think in our discussion tonight, even though we could, you know, use a lot of big words, we don't begin to encounter the amount of pain and suffering that actually exists through this whole process in life. So I see us as in fundamental agreement, actually, even though we're disagreeing about some categories.
Well, in Larry's comments at the very end, he teased us and said he might bring it up in the comment period. He said, if the liberals try to reconstruct the church, it would fail miserably. And I'd like to hear him expound on why you can't have a liberal church and why conservative churches work best.
They may not work best for some individuals in this room, but I'm going to argue with the weight of social science research over the past 25 years that has created a thunderous roar that conservative churches are the churches that attract people and the churches in which people are most likely to suggest that they experience an engagement with the spiritual, with the beyond, and to which in which most people vote with their feet to go to. Dean Kelly, who died just a few months ago, wrote a book in 1972 called Why Conservative Churches Are Growing. It was a study that the National Councils of Churches funded, and Dean wanted to talk, entitle it something quite different. You know, why liberal churches are declining. And the National Council of Churches said, no way, that's not the exact title. I'm paraphrasing it. Armin probably knows what the exact title was supposed to be. But since Dean's book, where he set forth the argument, the thesis, that conservative religions are the ones that when a variety of people have studied religion, here's a book by Dean Hoagie and colleagues on baby boomers, mainline Protestant baby boomers, focusing on Presbyterians, called Vanishing Boundaries, that looks at why Presbyterianism is losing its hold on its membership today. These people have virtually nothing to do with, this was an award-winning book, I think it won the 1995 Distinguished Book Award from the Social Science Association that studies religion. A few years earlier, this book by Roger Finke and Rodney Stark, The Church Union of America, 1776 to 1990, made a similar kind of argument, but from the perspective of sort of the conservative churches, arguing that it is demanding, exclusive religions that don't that claim they have something essential that no one else can have access to, and you can only get it by joining with them, and you've got to do a lot if you're going to be a part of us, and we're not going to tolerate free riders. We're not going to be inclusive. We're going to be exclusive with demands. Those are the churches that resonate for people. Those are the churches that grow. And that thesis is set out, I think, most clearly in this book. And it's a pretty solid argument that looks over the history of American religion and looks at the surging growth of Methodism and the Baptist movement in the early part of the 19th century, and then the decline of the Methodist denomination in the last half of the 19th century, and does all of that in comparison to the colonial Big Three. What I'm left with is this image that religion, and there are a lot of other people that have made the same argument, the religion that attracts people, that remains vital, is not the religion that animates me the most. And that's paradox for me. And that makes me be a little less arrogant when I want to start, you know, dissing any form of religion. It makes me a little more cautious. It's a paradox I live in. I don't know how to get out of it.
Part of the paradox, Larry, I think, is that you're making something be a religious issue, which is really a social psychology issue. All the studies that have been done of group affiliation show that the higher the cost, the more you value the membership. And that started with little boy campers all the way up through, that if you pay a high price for something, you think you convince yourself it's worth more, and therefore you stay more affiliated. And I think that addresses the membership and the order piece. I'm not sure it always addresses the meaning piece, and I think if you were to repeat those studies with exclusive clubs, or I had a student who very proudly showed me a brand because he was in a fraternity that actually branded the members, and his loyalty is just endless to that fraternity, and it's in part the cost piece of it. I'm not sure that it's just religion. I think it is that groups that are high cost for us, we justify, rationalize, and arrive at. And I'm not disagreeing with the paradox point. I'm saying I think we think we're very different in religious organizations when we're really expressing human psychology.
This is an issue that is raised all the time within this discussion. And those who have argued that it's conservative, demanding religion that wins say, you know, there's some truth to that, but that doesn't explain the full dynamic of what's going on. I mean, what's going on, it isn't that people want to bear high costs. I mean, I think about most of what I do in life, and I don't seek out those things that cost me the most to go do. You know, on Sunday morning, I'm not trying to figure out what I can do that is the most costly thing I can do, and that's going to draw me out of bed and get me down in the pew. Instead, the dynamic that these people have argued is that it's the net benefits you get from costly religion. Because costly religion doesn't tolerate free riders, that is, you can't be a half-hearted member. You got to, it's all or nothing. And because they're very demanding, they have all sorts of resources, both time and money. So they have incredible youth programs. They have great music. They can do activities after activities. High production value, vibrant community. I mean, these are traditions that tend to, whereas mainline Protestantism tends to see the mission of the church being the world. The mission of the congregation is the world, to bring Christ into the world in an effort to pursue peace and social justice. And that resonates for me. Conservative religions tend to see the mission of the congregation as the congregation itself, but it's always trying to broaden who's in that congregation through evangelization. And then once they get in there, there's all this go-go stuff to do with all the resources they have available. And it's a more vital, vibrant community for them. So it's partly maybe this cognitive dissonance by sacrificing a lot, but it's more than just that.
Oh, and when you say vitality, you mean what you said at breakfast was self-reported incidence of some spirituality is greater in religion, in conservatism.
I mean a variety of things. One of the things I mean is rates of religious affiliation, which are one of the arguments made here is that in 1776, 17% of Americans had formal church membership, and there were more people fornicating on Saturday night than in church on Sunday morning. Today we are a far more churched society. This is a story about how religious competition has led to greater levels of formal religious affiliation participation. But also, beyond that...
You better tell us the current percentage on Saturday night.
I'll just have to tell you that that's beyond the scope of my investigations at present.
I can tell you when it's higher than
70%. I'm on tape here. It also means that these people do tend to report higher incidences of spirituality. And if you look at basic data coming out of GSS or other kinds of national data sets, they pretty consistently show that when you look at the experiential dimension of religiosity, that is self-reported encounters with, you know, with the divine or whatever it may be, and different questions will ask it in different ways. Conservative Protestants score higher on that. Now, I'm willing to also say spirituality might be a lot of other things. Now, I'm chair of the Utah Wilderness Coalition, and I get warm, fuzzy feelings going out into nature, but I'm talking about a particular form of engagement when I'm talking about it.
My concern about those studies is that the membership piece is the primary criterion, and that's what people are self-reporting, is the membership and the spirituality. I mean, 75% of Americans believe in UFOs.
You do too.
No. I mean, that we are not clear in our society what spirituality is and what it means to us. And so when we're dealing with the self-report in which we have not made the criteria very clear, I don't think they're very helpful in judging what's going on. I think it is clear we are desperate for values, we're desperate for religion, and that there is a very good reason why conservative religions are growing is because we hope more order. We hope it's true that if we follow the rules.
I'm not willing to spend it.
Yeah.
In danger of just saying the same thing again and again, I think one of the reasons religions are conservative and
have demands of orthodoxy are so successful is that they are very successful at training through those beginning developmental stages. They get you to a certain stage. And I'm going to quote a couple of pieces of research that I don't have exact memory for exact figures on, but I think I'm in the ballpark. And someone who I'm actually not going to quote her because then she would be involuntarily committed to this tape in this audience. So essentially I've talked to somebody who's done a lot of research among Mormon women, and a number of years ago did a study of polling active Mormon women about whether they saw themselves as more conservative or as more liberal. And 70% said, I am neither, and I don't have a name for it. The same person told me that it's common, and I don't know whether the exact percentage is 50 or 60%, but most adults in the Mormon church, 50 or 60%, spend at least 1 year of their life inactive. So not everybody sitting in the pews, paying tithing, going to the temple, whatever, even with the high rates of reported orthodoxy. Keep in mind, you can be active in the church if you go once a month, according to research stuff, research standards most of the time, are not in this stage. So I think we're talking about some differences about how things are researched and the words and labels that are put on it. I would guess that most adults with the more ambivalent stage, actually, even though they may remain for their entire lives very active, very orthodox, be temple recommend bearing or may not, although I believe it's only, again, Larry, you're going to have to correct me here, something like 15 or 20% of the adult population of the church who hold the temple recommend. So most of us are actually, I believe, in an ambivalent stage or in a stage where we're in that conjunction process of either or and both and where do we go. But what is most true is that for the stages of development after, I'm trying to not say hierarchical, but after in chronological age, after the younger stages, is that it's an individual process, and you develop that idiosyncratic relationship within your social community, and that's not well studied or well researched, because it is, after all, an individual process.
And idiosyncratic.
And idiosyncratic.
Let's take time for some brief questions or comments, or questions or brief comments from the audience. In fact, Greg, do you want to take the mic? Greg is a deacon, and so
no white shirt.
And so we actually, it may not stretch all the way back to the people back there, but if you want to say something, stand up and he'll bring the mic really fast.
I have enjoyed all of this, but I do have a question, and that, it seems to me, is rather fundamental. All of these things are talking about institutions that have already been formed. Now, what about the innovators? What about Jesus? What about Joseph Smith? What about Martin Luther? What about Martin Luther King? What about Gandhi, who go in the teeth of something and start a new tradition? What you have described is I think, very true, all of it. But do you get to something new and developing? Or does somebody have to say, well, all this is fine, but how do I go about innovating if I think that something is wrong? And how much am I relying on somebody else to take the responsibility for my behavior? Because I think those are rather fundamental.
I think you're absolutely right. Matthew Fox in Coming of the Cosmic Christ talks about the difference between mystics and non-mystics, and it's very clear Joseph Smith was a mystic and Brigham Young was not, in terms of styles. And I don't know if the Utah branch would look more like the reorganized church if Joseph had lived, or if Brigham had not taken over, or if Joseph's son had taken over. Those are all very interesting historical questions. I think, again, it comes down to how strongly you need order and how strongly you need membership, because if you can't push, if you can't say, I give up the membership, I give up all of that, then you will not be able to innovate. and each of those people that you mentioned in some ways went counter to the tradition. I would leave Martin Luther King out of that, I think, because he really built on the work of black women. The membership piece becomes, how far are you willing to go?
I actually think there are plenty of innovators around. And I think many people are doing it in small ways, and some people do it in large ways. The reason some people, we know about them and study them, is that for some lucky set of accidents and reasons, and based on maybe institutional help, they became famous. So that Martin Luther King is famous and did some things, or Gandhi is famous and did some things, and I'm giving them all credit, by the way. But other people have done equally important things and have not become famous and have not represented to us. And I would submit that many of those people are women, and many of those people are of different races. And they have written. I have two sons-in-law who are very good at music. I am not. And I have discovered since they've been married to my daughters, that there are a lot of musicians that are far better than the ones who are famous. And so it's sometimes a set of happy accidents. I may be really branded as a heretic saying this, but I think Joseph Smith would never have gotten where he got if it hadn't been for Brigham Young. And he died soon enough, too, meaning that if he had lived longer, he may have developed a different sort of reputation, or things might have come together differently. So we develop a myth or a mythic representation of what we need at the time, and that person carries it for us. Eleanor Roosevelt is such a person for women, for many women in the United States now, because she is historical now. And what she was personally and what her biography was, that is idiosyncratic to her, but we develop that. And so I think because we are not likely to become famous and because we're not likely to prevail to start a new religion, I still think we should be as innovative as we want to be.
I guess my question would be directed mainly to Mary Beth, but it seems like that the three stages you described, that most people go through those stages, I think, when it comes to things other than religion. That is, you know, everybody, I think, kind of goes through those stages in terms of what they like to eat and how they like to dress and what their politics are and what sports they like, if they like them at all. But it seems to me, in looking at people, at least in my part of the church, that if they're going into that second stage and resolving it, they're doing that in the closet. And maybe that's so. Maybe they're being silent about this. And maybe, I'm certain now that the church, the atmosphere in the church now, does not foster an open dialogue for this type of questioning and going through this questioning stage to reach integration. You've got to do it on your own, basically, or with some select friends, or through Sunstone, or whatever. I wonder if you have any comment on that idea about that people, that we, at least it seems to Mormon religion, that we don't offer to people an open, acceptable sort of let's share things in this questioning and trying to get integrated when it comes to the Mormon religion.
I see that. I would agree and disagree. I would agree in the sense that I think that's true, but I think that's true of all conservative religions. The Catholic Church... it's just Catholic Church essentially did the same thing to Matthew Fox that Reba's talking about as happened to our six friends of a few years ago. And so most conservative, orthodox, or fundamentalist churches have no allowance for that. The second thing I would say, yes, that it's essentially an argument within the self, a deconstruction and reconstructing within the self, but we do talk to friends. Women and men talk to same-gendered, other-gendered friends all the time. The other thing I think that it's happening that I think is wonderful is that there are enough of us who show up, ask questions, we're on tape, somebody else can listen, that I really think there is a large community, and you probably have some ideas about numbers, Albert, of people who can carry this on within themselves and talk or read that wasn't available 30 years ago. It was not available 20 years ago. So when I, for instance, watch my two children, who are very orthodox and very active, I know that should they have questions of certain sort come up, I have things to give them. I have things beyond myself to share, which I didn't have.
I'm just a little confused about terms liberal and conservative, especially in relationship to the topic spirituality versus the institutional church, because it seems to be sort of the unspoken feeling that liberalism or being liberal equates to being spiritual and conservative equates to being institutional. Could you comment on that?
I think that's a conclusion that could be drawn from the language we've used. I can only speak for myself, but I don't think any of us intended to imply that, but it's a very logical conclusion to draw from the way we've talked about it. Conservative and liberal for me have no meaning, especially as a native Utahn. Since I'm conservative anywhere outside of the state and a flaming radical liberal inside the state, and I don't ever change in any way. But I think that's why Mary Beth has tried to talk about the individual meaning, Larry's tried to talk about the individual meaning, how all of us have tried to say it's the paradox, and we can't draw conclusions about any other person's journey like labeling them liberal or conservative, because we don't have any idea what the variables were that got them to the choices they made, nor do we have any right to judge them.
Maybe time for one more comment. Jean, over here. No.
I don't want Larry to be left out of this, so let me ask you a question, Larry. You mentioned the power of what are called conservative elements to give, I guess, using the other typology, meaning and order to churches and make them successful. And I think most of us have a feeling that it requires something like liberal elements, I'm sorry, membership in order and liberal elements to give meaning. Can you imagine a church that would have both kinds of elements, that would have the kinds of conservative qualities that would give it membership and order, and the liberal qualities that would give it deeper meaning? And if so, what would it take to move Mormonism more in that direction? I was very interested in, it seems to me we do have combinations of qualities. Sterling McMurrin has pointed out that one of the amazing things about Mormonism is it has a very conservative personal morality and a very liberal theology, and we've somehow lived with that, although we seem to be losing our liberal theology, if you believe the President Hinckley's comments in Mormons Incorporated. What would be your ideal about how we could move to keep both, or to move towards both?
The most straightforward, honest answer is, I don't know, let's do lunch. I've been teaching a course, just finished today, on the Enlightenment Project, Emergence of Modern Society, and Postmodern Critiques of the Modern Society. And the last question that the students posed, this was a student-generated question that we spent the last 20 minutes or so reflecting on, and when we said the words, the whole class laughed at the question, because it seemed to be almost an oxymoron. But they asked, is it possible to be a postmodern Orthodox Mormon? And they wanted to know, because they were pretty sure coming out of the class that that's what they wanted to be. You know, they were very suspicious of the rational by the end of the class. You know, and they were very suspicious of discourse. And they were very suspicious of rationally privileging one discourse over another.
whether it be liberal or conservative.
Which you just did.
Yeah. So they were very suspicious, but they also wanted to be very orthodox and traditional. And so we sort of talked around it, and I told them what I thought it would look like. And it's a formulation that I don't think would be particularly possible right now, but the process of even talking about it in that classroom in some ways was very liberating, at the same time that we were not distancing ourselves from Orthodox Mormonism. We weren't distancing ourselves from asserting at the level of faith commitments to certain very Orthodox traditional elements of our tradition. And I think that sort of conversation might lead us in a direction where we might be able to simultaneously juggle all of those things. I don't know. On the other hand, it might be a conversation that only the intelligentsia or the quasi-intelligentsia could have and would bore the rest of the people to tears and really isn't possible. I don't know. But that, I think it would be somehow pushing that conversation and pushing it in the context of not being so pissed off at our institutional church, like some kind of adolescent in stunted rebellion against their parents, that we can't ever really have the serious conversation. Now, no one's going to take people here seriously if we're always so ticked off with the institutional church that we just sound like a bunch of whiny adolescents talking about their parents. So, you know, somehow it's getting to that more serious, respectful kind of conversation at the same time that maybe we're embracing some pretty radical postmodern kinds of concepts about not privileging one particular discourse against another. I don't know. Maybe that's it.
I would just, I can't hear myself, but I guess I'm expecting to as a microphone. I think it would be very interesting, at least to me it's very interesting, to imagine what might we all be thinking about or doing that would relate in any way to what we now call religion if we never heard the word religion or been taught that that's what you're supposed to do and be and aim toward. And it seems to me that we're kind of stuck in a mode of imagining that this is the thing to do. And I suspect that maybe it isn't. I wonder if religion would always come bubbling forth from somewhere and whether it would always take the form of a good person who could never do any wrong and whom we must all then worship and adore. I doubt it.
Thank you. Anyone, a final comment here?
Yeah, I have one.
No, the panel I'm talking about. Sorry. we're close on time, so what? Brief.
I guess my answer would be you may not be but on the other hand, flipping them off and running out to the car to have a night, you know, spend the night away from home isn't going to initiate the conversation either. But you want to know something though? I'm very empathetic to the person who flips off their parents sometimes.
Okay, what a note to end on.
I think that was Reba that made that last comment.
Without thanks.
These are questions that perennially, daily, I struggle with. I find God in church, and the church calls me, and I find the church calls me to live a holy life. And I find, even when I am not thinking I'm Mormon, that the way in which I think about God and religion and the way they percolate and bubble up in my life are still very Mormon. And I'm trapped in my Mormon symbols, and I'm very happy and comfortable with that now. The hymn that we will close on, Sing Praise to Him, I chose because when Peggy Fletcher, 11, 12 years ago, and others tried to persuade me to come to Sunstone, and I kept saying no, and I was reluctant, I was in Salt Lake City at Mormon History Association, which was also the farewell banquet for Peggy Fletcher, and I was debating and praying about coming to Sunstone. And I went to Temple Square, because the conference was over at the Hotel Utah, and I wandered around Temple Square trying to figure out what I should do. And while I was sitting down on some stone barrier by the gardens, all of a sudden this pre-recorded Tabernacle Choir hymn burst forth. And it was this hymn. And it was during this hymn that I felt not that God wanted me to come to Sunstone, but that it was okay for me to come to Sunstone. Actually, the small revelation I had at the time said to me, it's okay if you do it, if you continue following the path to holiness that you're concerned about. But the phrase that brought forth that thinking was the phrase in one of the verses which says, within the kingdom of his might, lo, all is just and all is right. And I never really even knew the hymn before, but now it's become a personal favorite of mine. So let's sing it with gusto as we close. And the prayer will be then followed by Donna.